we got one lead off a DNA hit that led to multiple interviews and hundreds of hours of investigation.
Anchorage police make arrests in a decade-old rape case. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, firefighters work to contain the Funny River fire and worry about continued dry conditions this weekend.
The Kenai's a tinderbox right now, and we need to behave appropriately.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project.
The Anchorage Police Department arraigned two suspects yesterday in a sexual assault case from 2003. They say they reopened the case after a DNA sample from one of the suspects matched the sample taken from the victim nearly 11 years ago. According to the police department, in November of 2003, a woman was leaving a bar in Midtown Anchorage. Her ride had left the bar already, so she accepted a lift from an unknown male. Instead of taking her home, she says she was taken to an East Anchorage apartment. She reported she was brutally sexually assaulted by at least seven young men. The men eventually left her at a shopping center. Within a few hours, she reported the incident to the police and was examined. Detective Brett Sarber says in 2003, the survivor was unable to provide details about the suspects or where the attack happened. The case went cold until 2011. Then Orland Sutliff was convicted of a crime and his DNA was entered into a database. It matched with DNA collected off the victim.
I mean, we got one lead off a DNA hit that led to multiple interviews and hundreds of hours of investigation. And here we are with two people that have been indicted, and we believe that we have other people identified that were involved in the case.
He says without the victim reporting early, they could not have pursued the case.
Early reporting is critical to getting the DNA evidence off of a person's body. So I would highly encourage that.
The detectives explained when victims are examined, forensic nurses collect samples that are sent to the crime lab to extract different DNA profiles. Victims are also given counseling and treated for other medical concerns. 31-year-old Orland Sutliff and 29-year-old Antoine Archbale were arrested and arraigned earlier this week. The investigation is ongoing. The police do have persons of interest. The Funny River fire on the Kenai Peninsula has topped 67,000 acres, and the combination of Memorial Day weekend and extreme fire conditions have firefighters concerned. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Jim Schwarber is a public information officer with the Alaska Incident Management Team on the Funny River fire. He says the fire has been growing gradually in nearly every direction and is within a few miles of some communities along the Sterling Highway and the Bear Creek subdivision on Tustamina Lake.
We have folks working along all those areas to work towards securing that line to try to hold the fire back.
So far, the fire hasn't caused any structural damage, but Schwarber says as part of the fire creeps west, firefighters are growing more concerned.
That's where the larger communities are, is on the west side of the fire, and we're putting a lot of effort into slowing and holding the fire so that it doesn't cause any damage.
There are around 375 personnel working on the Funny River fire, with more crews expected in the coming days. Schwarber says this fire is burning a lot hotter than fires normally do this early in the season, which makes it particularly dangerous.
The fire has been burning very active in typical fuels, but it's also been spreading and burning in mixed hardwoods, which is an area that typically slows a fire.
Certain fuels, like black spruce, tend to burn more actively later in the summer, but this year it's happening early. As the annual influx of campers make their way down to the peninsula for Memorial Day weekend, Schwarber says they need to be cognizant of the dangers.
The Kenai's a tinderbox right now, and we need to behave appropriately.
Red flag warnings are in effect for the western Kenai Peninsula and the Matanuska-Susitna Valley. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The Alaska Division of Forestry says all burning is banned on the Kenai Peninsula. Go to alaskapublic.org for more details. The Tyonek fire on the western side of Cook Inlet is holding steady at just more than 1,800 acres. Sam Harrell, a public information officer with the Alaska Division of Forestry, says winds yesterday pushed the fire back onto itself.
We're still seeing a lot of smoke and activity, but that's inside the perimeter of the fire where it's blowing back on itself, and that's a good thing to clean up those fuels out there.
Harrell says infrastructure around Beluga at the north end of the fire remains undamaged. No evacuation orders are in effect for Tyonek or Beluga. Russ Millett, who was ousted as leader of the state Republican Party following a contentious election, plans to run for governor. Millett spokesman Matt Millett, Russ Millett's son, said his father was filing a letter of intent to run today. Millett plans to challenge Governor Sean Parnell for the Republican nomination in August. He is running under the auspices of the Alaska Republican Assembly, which Matt Millett described as the conservative wing of the party as opposed to the establishment wing. Russ Millett was elected chairman of the state GOP with the help of fellow Ron Paul supporters during a tumultuous 2012 convention. But party leaders voted to oust him last year before he took over. The party, at its most recent convention, changed its rules, making future attempted takeovers more difficult. The head of the state's biggest labor union has filed a complaint against Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan, who is running for lieutenant governor. Alaska AFL-CIO President Vince Beltrami argues that Sullivan inappropriately used government resources for the purposes of his campaign. Earlier this month, Sullivan came under fire for likening mandatory union dues to slavery at a lieutenant governor candidate forum and subsequently issued an apology through his spokesperson in the mayor's office. Beltrami holds that the apology should not have been delivered by municipal staff, and it amounts to a violation of statute. Sullivan told the Anchorage Daily News he believes there is no merit to the complaint. The Alaska Public Offices Commission will review the matter within 30 days. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a scavenger hunt with a purpose in Unalaska.
I knew who these people were, but I never really got to know them, so it's been nice to actually get to know them a little bit more personally.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
The Pebble Limited Partnership filed suit Wednesday in federal court seeking to halt the process underway by the EPA to stop development of the proposed Pebble Mine. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Earlier this year, the Environmental Protection Agency officially started the process to use its authority under the Clean Water Act to basically veto the issuance of dredge and fill permits that would be absolutely necessary for the development of the controversial mining project in the Bristol Bay region. The Pebble Limited Partnership, which is seeking to develop the Pebble Mine, decided to take the issue to court, and they filed suit Wednesday. Mike Heatwall is a spokesman for the partnership. He says the partnership firmly believes the EPA does not have the authority to do what it's doing.
The legal background under the Clean Water Act, that we view that the authority does not exist for them to preemptively stop a project, and that's one of the key components of our litigation.
The Pebble Limited Partnership is asking the court to issue an injunction to stop the EPA's process. The partnership contends that without an actual permit application, which has not yet been forthcoming, the EPA's actions exceed the authority granted the agency under the Clean Water Act. Heatwall admits the EPA has the authority to invoke its 404C veto authority, but he says the partnership's attorneys believe the agency cannot do so preemptively, which is what the agency is seeking in this instance. Opponents of the proposed Pebble Mine claim the agency has such an authority, and they point to an example where the authority was actually used. However, Heatwall says the partnership believes they and the EPA are misreading what actually happened.
There were three identical parcels of property, I believe, in Florida, two of which had filed for permits and had some level of environmental review that the EPA vetoed. And in that they swept in the third property. So, really identical circumstances, smaller properties that we're talking about here, not a wholesale stopping of a pretty significant mineral or resource development project, and carving out authority that is unprecedented under the Clean Water Act.
The proposed Pebble Mine is very controversial due to its location in or near some of the most important salmon habitat on Earth. Many organizations dedicated to preserving the Bristol Bay region's tremendous salmon resource are adamantly opposed to development of the mine. The Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association, which represents the commercial drift net fishermen in Bristol Bay, was quick to react to the lawsuit filed by the Pebble Limited Partnership. In a prepared statement, the group's executive director wrote that instead of working with the EPA or submitting its long-awaited official permit applications, Pebble has chosen to file a Hail Mary lawsuit in hopes of further delaying EPA's public process. Catherine Carscallon from Dillingham is the sustainability director for the BBRSDA. She disputes the contention that the EPA is setting a national precedent by using its 404C veto authority on the proposed Pebble Mine.
Well, EPA has had this authority for about 40 years, and they've only used it 13 times. And only once before have they used it proactively like we're requesting. So I don't see how this sets any sort of precedent or opens up new opportunities for EPA. They've always had this opportunity. They're just very careful about where they use it.
The suit challenging the EPA's 404C process was filed Wednesday in the Federal District Court. So far, no hearings have been scheduled. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
A measure before Sea Alaska shareholders could alter the way board elections are held, and that could bring leadership changes. The measure comes as 13 shareholders compete for 4 board seats in the Southeast Alaska Regional Native Corporation's annual election. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from Juneau.
The measure is a resolution proposing limits to what's called discretionary voting. That's an option on Sea Alaska's proxy ballot, which lists candidates for the board of directors. When shareholders check a box, they give the board the power to cast their ballots for whomever they see fit. And the board votes for its slate of incumbents seeking re-election.
It's an unfair document because of the discretionary voting, and that is what has kept all our directors in all these years.
Mick Beasley is a Juneau Carver who's campaigned against discretionary voting. He's also one of this year's 6 independent board candidates. He authored the resolution that would largely eliminate discretionary voting. Without it, shareholders would pick and choose from the full list of candidates, including incumbents and their challengers.
If this resolution passes and we amend our bylaws, it'll make it equal voting rights for all shareholders.
They would wipe out what Sea Alaska believes would otherwise be a valid vote.
Nicole Hollingstad is Sea Alaska's communications vice president as well as corporate secretary. She and the board oppose Beasley's measure.
Those shareholders understand exactly what discretionary voting means, are offering their shares in support of the corporation, and that to remove that discretionary voting option would remove a choice that at least a quarter of our shareholders select on a regular basis.
The resolution does not completely eliminate discretionary voting. Beasley says it would be allowed when an independent group challenges the board and issues its own ballot.
If there are 2 slates, 2 proxies, then discretionary voting is fair game. When there is only 1 proxy, and that's Sea Alaska putting the proxy out, they cannot use discretionary voting unless there's another proxy that comes out.
Shareholders are rarely faced with 2 slates and proxies, but this year they are. A group calling itself 4 Shareholders for Sea Alaska has sent out its own ballot and posted it online. The 4 top vote-getters will win 3-year terms on the 13-member board. Results will be announced at Sea Alaska's annual meeting June 28th in Seattle. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The draft supplemental environmental impact statement for a road out of Juneau is now under review by the Federal Highway Administration. That's the last step in the process before Federal Highways names a preferred route and issues a record of decision. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports.
State Transportation Department spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says the final SEIS, as it's called, is expected sometime in the next 6 weeks.
If it gets the blessing and we don't need to do any more revisions to it, we'll stamp draft on it and we can release it for public review.
Once that happens, DOT would hold hearings in Juneau, Haines, and Skagway. Federal Highways issued a record of decision in 2006 to build a road between Juneau and Cansahine, where motorists would board a state ferry for the rest of the trip north. Conservation groups immediately filed suit, and in 2009, the U.S. District Court ruled the environmental impact statement was invalid because it didn't consider improved ferry service in Lynn Canal. That decision was upheld in 2011 by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that required the supplemental study. Little by little, however, the road north has grown, completed last summer to Echo Cove. This year, $35 million is in the state's budget for another extension. Woodrow says $30 million are federal funds and $5 million comes from the state.
The talking point was that that would help us begin constructing the road toward Kensington. And really how this road is going to be built, no matter what, is it's going to be constructed in phases. It's just such a large project.
It's one of those mega projects the state may not be able to afford, says Juneau Representative Sam Keto III. He told the Juneau Chamber of Commerce Thursday that Juneau Access has a lot of competition statewide. Keto is a civil engineer and admits he likes big projects, but he wonders about the return for the estimated $500 million investment.
Do we receive $500 million worth of commerce or revenue back to the state or to the city? I think that's a tough one to support.
Keto didn't curry much favor with the chamber audience. The business organization and most of its members have long been road advocates.
Personally, I don't have a strong feeling about we should build a road. We should not build a road.
Because that road ends at a state ferry terminal.
There may be some savings because the ferry is operating as a day boat as opposed to a 24-hour ferry, but there's still ferry costs, which means you still have 12 hours worth of fuel. You're not going to be running full all the time. There may be ferries that are running mostly empty, and then you're going to have an additional 65 miles of road to maintain.
Keto's questions and concerns should be answered when Federal Highways releases that final SEIS and Record of Decision sometime this summer. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations and communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ellen Lockyer. This week on AK, Scavenger Hunt. Small towns like Unalaska can be pretty close-knit. Grown-ups take care of kids who aren't their own, and teenagers have adults to turn to when they need them. One local high schooler wanted to make those relationships stronger, so she planned something special. She put students and adults into teams and sent them on a town-wide scavenger hunt. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has the story.
This is the sound of a community coming together.
Go.
That's a scavenger hunt team completing a challenge, stage a dramatic earthquake scene in a public place. Groups of adults and high schoolers have been running all around town for a week, doing activities like that and getting a little closer in the process. And that was 18-year-old Christian Escalante's idea when she put this event together. Last fall, the high school senior went to a youth leadership conference in Anchorage. It focused on combating violence and promoting respect and equality in communities around the state.
We talked about what changes we can make in our community, and one of the things I noticed was that there wasn't enough youth and adult participation in the community, so that's how I started my project.
Escalante got an $1,800 grant from the conference to make it happen. She set up the teams, trying to mix up people who were new in town with longtime residents and pairing up kids and adults who didn't know each other. They had a week to get through more than 60 tasks, taking pictures or video of themselves doing different things.
They're definitely at least getting a sense of like the kids, and the kids are getting a sense of the adults that they've never met before. They're also doing new stuff in places that they didn't know they would do, like building sandcastles at Summers Bay or doing silly things at the store.
Each task had a point value. At stake were cash prizes funded by the grant. And doing silly things seemed to be a priority. One of Escalante's favorite challenges, creep from the front to the back of the local Safeway like a ninja or a spy.
Okay, don't go too fast because I gotta follow you. You guys are being bad ninjas.
Yeah, you guys suck.
That's Emily Brooke and Alicia Richardson filming their teammates trying to be sneaky by ducking into racks of sweatshirts or hiding along shelves of detergent. Don't hear anything? Exactly. So being kind of goofy in public is one way to get to know each other. Other tasks ask teams to just hang out together or get to know their town, finding local landmarks, going on adventures, and volunteering at different nonprofits. On the very last day of scavenger hunting, another team is driving around trying to squeeze in some last-minute points. Ross Enlow is one of the teenagers on that team. Already, they've hiked Mount Ballyhoo in Dutch Harbor, cooked together, and had a dance party.
Today, we're going to plan on go to Summers Bay and either find the horses or right in the sand, have to have a meal together, and create something. Then after that, we'll be done.
Those are worth 60 points altogether. Summers Bay is just outside town. On the way, the team spots a pile of melting snow and decides their creation will be a tiny snowman.
Yeah, there you go.
We need sticks.
Oh, yeah, I have them.
Oh. We should, I just want to make this look really big, so we should take it from a downward angle. Just, like, make it look way bigger.
Oh, my God.
They snap their picture, that's 20 points down, and leave their masterpiece in the road. The wild horses that roam the valley are nowhere in sight, so instead, they draw a heart in the sand. Amber Lee, another teenager on the team, is their struggling artist.
Oh my God, how do I do the other half?
Well, then the effort was like socks.
The other half always sucks.
So much pressure.
That's adult teammate Joanna Tellman. She runs a local consignment shop, and she says it's been fun to spend the week making some new connections.
I knew who these people were, but I never really got to know them, so it's been nice to actually get to know them a little bit more personally, and it's been a lot of fun.
The team has to submit all their photos and videos by the end of the day, and after Summers Bay, they've checked off all but a few activities. When the results are announced the next day, though, they find out they didn't win. Still, Tellman's glad they all participated. As for Christian Escalante, the organizer, she had one final test for the top three teams as a tiebreaker, a quiz to see how much the kids had learned about their adult teammates and vice versa.
Okay, where did your person go to school?
Oh,
oh,
Oregon.
Duke. What? College in Oregon.
Oh.
Somewhere in Oregon.
That's a half.
Overall, Escalante says she was impressed with what she heard.
They knew a lot about each other, a lot more than I thought they would.
And she hopes they can do it all again next year, with new teams and new challenges. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Kobuk in northwest Alaska. The village of about 200 people is steadily growing, nearly doubling in size since 2000. A resident says that's in part due to reliable seasonal work and efforts to mesh traditional lifestyles with modern ones.
My name is Beatrice Barr. I live in Kobuk, and I'm a tribe clerk. Kobuk is a remote native village, and it's accessible by boat, four-wheeler, to the next village. And we live right in front of the Brooks Range. There's mainly summer jobs for the young kids. You know, we're trying to get them to work every year after school. And there's Nova Copper, who is mining at bornite. So it's a seasonal job where Amler, Sungnak, Kobuk, any of the villages, any of the 12 villages can apply for any job openings up at with Nova Copper. For fun, the kids, they go through survival, how to survive out here in the country, especially during the winter. We started cultural camp for the kids. They love that. They just built a new gym this year, so the kids had that opportunity to finally go play ball, basketball at the gym. When I was in eighth grade, we had no high school, so we got shipped out to boarding school, which was either Monetcom or Nenana or Galena. And so now they finally have a high school. They finally have a high school where the kids, they can either school here or continue with the boarding school in Galena or Nenana or Monetcom. And which kids now, they're doing that. That'll give them the opportunity to be away from home, and then after school, they don't have to stay home their whole life. They could, you know, continue to move on with that experience. My favorite part about it is just living in the village. I tried living in the city. It was just too much noise, too much, you know, traffic. And living in a community, you get to learn how to subsist, hunt, anything of that nature. Elders want to teach us here. And I love living in the village.
Beatrice Barr is a tribal clerk in Kobuk. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Annie Ropeek, Jolene Almendarez, Dave Waldron, and Annie Feit. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Ed Schoenfeld and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a good weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.